Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon. It is Monday afternoon, August 26th, 2013, and it's a beautiful summer day here in Fairfax, Virginia. And welcome to Military Monday. Before we start the show, I want to go ahead and call note to an event that will be going on later this afternoon. Over at the White House, not that far from where we are, there's going to be a ceremony, and only the fifth living Medal of Honor recipient since 9/11 is going to be awarded the Medal of Honor. His name is Ty Michael Carter, and he is going to be given this nation's highest decoration for valor above and beyond the call of duty. You're going to hear a lot about this young man here in the not-too-distant future. If you get a chance, see him on the evening news, go to the Pentagon channel, and perhaps watch the ceremony over. But we don't want to ever forget that the people out there on the sharp end of the stick, yes, they're all brave, but there's some of them who do just a bit more, a whole lot more. And we send our best wishes and congratulations to Staff Sergeant Ty Michael Carter, who lived to pick up his medal. Hooah, Sergeant. And with that, we're going to move on to the show. As most people are aware, D-Day, Operation Overlord, the invasion of Normandy in 1944, was one of the great maritime undertakings of all time. And in fact, it was an undertaking which tried to do something which a lot of other people had tried and failed at. The Armada, which tried to invade England during Elizabethan times, broke up on the rocks in France in the midst of a storm and attacks by fire ships. Napoleon Bonaparte couldn't do it. Neither could Adolf Hitler. So in 1944, when the Allies undertook to do the exact same thing, this was not an easy task. And while we know a great deal about the great, great things done by land forces on D-Day and subsequent weeks and months, not a lot is talked about with regards to the maritime problem of getting an army from one shore to the other. One would think, it's not that far. It's a few hours by boat. But anybody who's been there knows the English Channel is one of the ugliest, deadliest, nastiest bodies of water in the world. And today we're going to have a guest who's going to talk to us about that challenge and how the Allies helped overcome it. He is a professor at the National Defense University at Fort McNair over in Washington, D.C. He is the author of last year's book, The Gators of Neptune, from U.S. Naval Institute Press. I'd like to introduce a friend and someone I respect a lot, Christopher David Young. Chris, are you out there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, John, for that kind invitation and introduction.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. And just so people know, if you want to talk to Mr. Young or myself, please feel free to call in during the show. Our call-in number is 347-945-7246. Again, that number is 347-945-7246, and we'll try and get you into the queue. Chris, I guess my first question is, what made you want to write a book about this particular topic, the maritime challenges, as well as some of the technical challenges of getting across the English Channel onto the shores of Normandy?
Well, we have to back up a little bit about my career background. But prior to being at National Defense University, I was a defense analyst at the Center for Naval Analysis, and I was on assignment to Amphibious Group 2, which is the Atlantic Fleet's largest amphibious force then, back in the late 90s. And so I was steeped in amphibious planning, amphibious operations, And it occurred to me one day when I was visiting another command, I saw a picture of the Normandy landings, and it occurred to me that the amount of effort that it must have taken to plan that or to to think through what you needed to do to conduct that operation must have been enormous. So I developed an interest, a general interest in taking that on. So I contacted the editors at Naval Institute Press, and they said, why don't you take it on as a project yourself? And a few years later, I ended up with a book.
Now, it's worth noting that for, you know, there are literally hundreds of books in many different languages about D-Day, and yet there is a strikingly thin picking regarding the naval elements of it. I mean, obviously there's a volume in Samuel Eliot Morison's classic series, you know, the United States Navy in World War II. I remember there was a thin little Ethan Allen book in the 1970s, but since that time, not a whole lot, is there?
No, no. I think what you'll find is what books do exist with regard to the Navy side of this, either talked only about the United States side of it, or the British side of it, or some narrow aspect of it. But you're right; there are very few. There aren't a lot of books written on the subject. And I think that it comes down to perhaps the bias that came out of the Second World War. That is that Europe was the Army's war, and the Pacific was the Navy's war. So I think the fact that not many people wrote on the Navy's role in Europe, I think came about as a result of that bias.
True enough. And, of course, we've done more than a few shows about the maritime conflict in the European theater and the fact that before you were ever going to put shore on northern France, you had to win a couple of major campaigns in the North Atlantic just to be able to go ahead and set it all up.
That's right. That's right. Dress rehearsals had to happen prior to the Normandy invasion before they could actually think this thing through. I mean, you had the North Africa campaign, you had Sicily, you had the Italian campaign. You had a lot of different campaigns taking place in which the Allies could learn from, draw lessons from, and develop the operational plans from.
And let's make that sort of our point of departure, because there was one other thing that was going on, and that was raids, large-scale raids against targets on the European coast. And the masters of that for much of the early part of the war were the British commandos. And in 1942, they ran a couple of big ones, one against the port of Saint-Nazaire, where they were trying to blow up a dock as well as a number of other facilities, and, of course, the great raid on Dieppe, which ran in the spring of 42. What kind of things did the early planners of Overlord, by the way, who were primarily British at that time, as we were just getting into the war, what did the early British planners take from the experiences at Saint-Nazaire and Dieppe that began to go ahead and set their goals and objectives for what would become Operation Overlord?
Well, interestingly enough, the two raids that you just cited were disasters. They led to a lot of bloodshed and they were not successful. So so the lessons that were drawn were mostly lessons that the Allies vowed not to repeat, mistakes they were not going to repeat. One in particular, a direct raid on a port, Saint-Nazaire. I believe the Allies then took the lesson from that to move away from directly attacking or conducting a landing right on a port. That was one of the lessons I believe they took away from that particular operation. With the Dieppe raid, they took some larger lessons. That is, for one thing, they needed a larger force to expand the lodgment once they landed. They took the lesson that they needed a wider front so that the enemy wouldn't know exactly where they were going to land. And also they needed a larger follow-on force to bring troops in to flow forces in. But again, Dieppe was also a disaster, and the Allies went back, or rather the British went back, and both from the Saint-Nazaire and the Dieppe raids, they had written in detail, here are the things we will not do again once we try and land again in Normandy, or wherever the site was going to be. They had not decided on Normandy right off the bat.
Now, some of the early things that they decided they did have to do, one was obviously they wanted to go ahead and put armor on the beach during the initial landings, find a way to put armor for fire support and combined arms benefits onto the beaches. But of course, at Dieppe, the shale beaches meant that the tanks that went in basically got hung up on the shale and never made it inland.
So
there was obviously a major study of coastlines, hydrography.
Yes, yes.
Each sand became an issue of study, did it not?
Yes, yes. Well, their whole let's back up a few minutes, for a second. The British began planning almost from the day that they got expelled from the continent, their disastrous operation in France, and Churchill, once as prime minister, began commissioning studies and setting up a command, Combined Operations Headquarters, Combined Operations Command, to start looking at what would be necessary to return to the continent. And so dozens and dozens of studies were undertaken to try and figure out exactly what the British would need in order to return to the continent. Some of those involved studying devices that they would need, which we can talk about in a minute, to return to the continent. Some of it involved the exact forces they would need in order to conduct the assault. Some of it required an understanding of German defenses. So Churchill, to his credit, had pretty much set the ball in motion to study the problem, to appoint people who would be obsessed with it, and essentially continue studying the problem over the next 4 years.
Now, by late 1942, United States is now the partner in the war, not yet the senior partner, but obviously an important partner in this endeavor. What kinds of things do the early planners of what would become Overlord, what are the parameters that they decide upon very early in that process, actually in 42, by the end of 42? Can you talk about things they made as assumptions?
Well, now this is a slow process, and in actuality, in early 42, the Americans showed up in England ready for action. They wanted to immediately go in and take the continent by storm, and the British were a little bit more hesitant. So you see, the documents show a lot of back and forth between the American planners and the British planners, and I would say that the American planners were much more eager to put forces ashore and get going with regard to defeating Germany, whereas the British were much, much more hesitant. So you see, for example, in very early 1942, General Marshall and Eisenhower showing up and indicating that they had put together plans. Sledgehammer was one particular example where they could put forces ashore with sufficient air cover and to then start assaulting France. So what you see is a lot of going back and forth between the British and the Americans over exactly what the requirements are in order to make this a successful assault. So the British had put together a plan called Roundup prior to 1942, and they were constantly revising it. But you see from early papers, the early planning documents with regard to Roundup, that the British were short on resources, short on everything. It was largely a wishful thinking exercise. For example, they would say, we can put two or three divisions in France with perhaps naval gunfire support involving four or five surface combatants and aircraft that is far less of what they actually truly needed. The Americans came in, and it indicated that they needed a wider front and that they would have to conduct landings and then pursue the Germans up into France. So, again, the two sides would go back and forth with regard to what the actual planning requirements were. The British were, again, very, very reluctant to immediately dive into the actual assault. The Americans were much more eager. And so you had a conversation going back and forth. Ultimately, the planners, you had American planners and British planners getting together, and they ultimately then concluded that they had insufficient landing craft, aircraft, naval gunfire support to conduct the operation in 1942 and that perhaps even into 1943.
Now, the British have to be looked upon with a certain respect here, since this was their home court. They'd they had gone and dealt with invasions, mostly coming their direction, for half a millennium at this point. They knew the English Channel. They knew the challenges that that body of water represented. Talk a little bit about that challenge that, you know, you'd think that, you know, at its narrowest point, it's what, 20-some miles? How tough can 20-some miles be?
Right.
Across. And your answer to that, having done a little research on this fact from your books, is?
Well, I mean, one of the biggest problems was the weather. That is, you had to precisely land at the right time, or else you were going to get to become a victim of the weather in the English Channel, which was particularly brutal. Secondly, you had a current problem. The English Channel has a pretty vicious current, and it also changes direction midstream, which would cause the Allies some difficulties. So weather, strong currents, and then in addition, you had the German defenses that you had to deal with. The German defenses, which were Fortress Europa, which certainly were not going to be easy to overcome, had to be something that the Allies had to account for. The Allied intelligence was indicating that there would be thousands, if not close to a million mines in the channel. The number of German armored divisions not far from the coast of France also had to be taken into account. And then the persistent presence of the Luftwaffe also had to be taken into account. So all those things had to be accounted for and had to be thought through before the Allies could immediately jump in and conduct the operation.
So you just touched on one of the biggies, a lesson that was fresh in the minds of the British and the Germans from the Battle of Britain, and that is nobody's going across the channel without air supremacy. And there was an interesting little number that defined where you could project air supremacy in the minds of the British planners in 1942, which ironically was the range of a Spitfire. Talk a little bit about that, and, you know, why couldn't they have maybe projected a little farther, since they technology was obviously going to go and advance somewhere in the next 2 to 3 years?
Well, I mean, the challenge would have been, first, by 1942, the Brits and the Germans were definitely in a struggle for air supremacy over the English Channel, to the point that even the establishment of bases and activities in England were always suspect or always in doubt. So until the United States showed up and until the Allies both won air superiority over the English Channel and were able to push the German air power presence back, could the Allies feel comfortable conducting the operation? Now, what the Allies ultimately decided to do was to engage in an operation known as Operation Point Blank, which was the specific purpose was to reduce the German air threat over the English Channel and over France in general. And what that was a deliberate effort to fly missions to draw out the Luftwaffe to then attrite the German aircraft capability. Ultimately, it worked. It ultimately got that combined with strategic bombing to reduce German aircraft production. Those two factors themselves reduced German aircraft capability, and I would argue ultimately led to the absence of the Luftwaffe on D-Day itself.
On the other hand, that didn't happen until literally the last minute, spring of 44, before we achieved air supremacy over the areas that we would be invading.
That's right. I mean, there are a bunch of things that happened up until the very last minute, but that certainly was one of the last minute accomplishments that the Allies could at least breathe a sigh of relief. The other activity that they had managed to bring about was the deception to the Germans not to essentially put their armored divisions right where the landing was to take place through such deceptive missions as Operation Fortitude, which had the Germans convinced they were going to land in Calais versus Normandy. So the Germans were constantly guessing where they might land. But you're right, the air superiority only took place until the very last minute.
And you just brought up another point. where do you land? You mentioned two places, Normandy, down on the coast south of England between Cherbourg and Le Havre, and the Pas-de-Calais, the narrowest part of the channel directly opposite of southeastern England. What were the merits of both, and why in the world was it important to decide this early as 1942?
Well, the merits are pretty obvious. With regard to the Pas-de-Calais, the short distance from England to the coast of France made this very appealing for the Allies. The Normandy landings were somewhat much, much further. In terms of maritime factors, the Navy originally had argued that, well, because of the close distance, this may be to our advantage, that we can ferry troops across much more quickly. The downside to the Pas-de-Calais was that the Germans expected the Allies to land there. Therefore, their defenses were likely to be stronger, more developed, and the Germans would have taken a longer time building up their fortifications and their defenses. They also would have likely placed their aircraft, airfields, more in that area than in the Normandy area. So the Normandy area, though further, would have been less defended. The Germans would less likely have expected the Allies to have landed there. And then one other factor, which the Navy ultimately recognized, that a lot of the naval forces were going to be coming around from long distances, perhaps in Wales and other, and Scotland and other parts of England, that the advantages of being of a close landing in Pas-de-Calais would have been neutralized by the fact that naval forces would have had to travel long distances anyway to get to the coast of France. So the Allies did wrestle with the selection of the lodgment for quite a while. There's plenty of notes on arguments between the different sides arguing which selection should take place. And I would say that although some of the earlier planners had come to the conclusion by 1942, early 1943, that Normandy was the answer, I would say that the documentation seems to suggest that even by the time that the chief of staff of the Supreme Allied Command showed up, the Cossack staff had showed up, they still hadn't even made that decision by mid-1943. They hadn't come to the final conclusion. And there was one final conference that they met and then decided it's going to be Normandy.
So in other words, they had been throwing this ball around for over a year, and only when Eisenhower finally arrived did a final decision get made, pretty much when he arrived.
Well, actually, prior to Eisenhower, his chief of staff had shown up and put the ball in rolling. So just before Eisenhower arrived, they had made the decision. So I wouldn't quite say that Eisenhower was the final straw that eventually brought it about. But his chief of staff, who showed up, definitely brought it about.
And you're talking about Bedell Smith, right?
Actually, this is the British chief of staff prior to Bedell Smith arriving.
Okay, so very good. So we've made there's the assumption you're going to do it on this roughly 50-60 mile strip running east west between Cherbourg and the Pas-de-Calais. You're not going to go for a port. That decision was also made fairly early, correct?
That's right.
And this has some real disadvantages, not the least of which is, how are you going to supply this massive army that you want to put of a couple of million men over a beach? Is it even
right.
possible, correct?
That's right. So the Allies had to come up with a number of different – they argued this point. The British felt that the way to do it was to create an artificial port, what ultimately became known as a Mulberry. These are gigantic monstrosities. Where they would sink concrete blocks, put causeways on top of them, and then run ships all the way up to the artificial port. So they felt that an engineering feat would answer the mail. The Americans actually had a different point of view. Some of the U.S. Navy participants felt that the liberal use of landing ship tanks, LSTs, directly landing on shore and allowing them to dry to land belly up and then to disgorge all the material would have been sufficient. So there was actually a debate between the Americans and the British over the utility of the mulberries versus the utility of LSTs. But the British, ultimately, who were in charge of a lot of the planning, won out. And so you ended up with the mulberry as the primary means to try and bring a lot of this material ashore in the absence of the direct taking of a port early on.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the major proponents of the mulberry ports was no less than Winston Churchill, who had a, shall we say, penchant for liking technical solutions to difficult problems.
Yes. Churchill was definitely a proponent of it, and he was an early proponent of it. Now, to be fair to Churchill also, he was an early proponent of a lot of what seemed to be crazy ideas related to amphibious operations that that actually ended up being quite fruitful. So, for example, the landing ship dock, a technology we still use today, was one of Churchill's early, either one of his ideas or one of the ideas he promoted once he got someone else to think through how do we do this with a ship. And the landing ship dock is a ship that can lower and raise itself, can stop in the water, lower and raise its hull, and then you can let a ramp out and let landing craft come out. You can flood the well deck and let landing craft leave the well deck and assault the beach. So Churchill was a proponent of a lot of what one might call crazy ideas, but he certainly had some good ones. He certainly had some stinkers, but he also had some good ones. Another idea that the British came up with was a duplex drive tank, which was a tank with a skirt around it, which allowed it to go into the water and be essentially become an amphibious tank to go into the water and then assault the beach. So the duplex drive tank, the mulberry, they had to create some breakwaters to prevent to at least reduce damage done to some of the ships and landing craft ashore from storms. A lot of these ideas Churchill promoted, and he had staffs thinking through constantly about what kinds of inventions, engineering feats do we need in order to make this happen. Those are just a few examples. There are many, many more.
And when we talk about Festung Europa, Fortress Europe, that had been created over the 4 years since Dunkirk, we're talking about a very tough nut to crack. The Germans, who are obviously noted for their engineering and warfare prowess, had done a pretty good job of fortifying the various possible landing sites throughout Europe, and Normandy was no exception to this.
That's correct. Although initially the planners had observed that Normandy was less defended, less fortified than, say, the Pas-de-Calais, by the time 1944 had come around, and Rommel had actually been placed in charge of a lot of erecting some of the defenses, Festung Europa was quite formidable, including long-range guns that could take out some of the ships, Allied ships. They had several pillboxes and fortifications that would have been very, very difficult to crack. And so the Allies had to think through how do you get through tons of concrete, barbed wire fences, mines, obstacles laid along the beach and not far offshore. So they had to think through the doctrinal and the tactical processes to directly take on some of these obstacles and defenses.
In a very real sense, this was a siege. The initial stages of the invasion were going to be perhaps the ultimate siege in terms of taking down a fortress or a castle, except on a much bigger scale than anything that had been imagined during the Crusades or the Knights of the Round Table.
That's correct. And so a big question was, how do you go about reducing, as in siege warfare, you use firepower, use a number of different engineering capabilities to try and take out, reduce, or destroy the fortifications, the defenses. So the Allies had to think through, all right, so we have these very strong fortifications. How do we take them out? Now, what was interesting was that you had a debate going on both with the Allies, both with the British and the Americans. The American experience in the Pacific was that you use your naval gunfire support to directly reduce the defenses. And so their experience had been, over time, you bring your ships in close and you just bombard the defenses for long periods of time until there's essentially rubble and nothing left. Now, the British then pointed out to the Americans that, well, you have that luxury in the Pacific. For one thing, you're not dealing with the English Channel, which is much shallower. You're dealing with a much deeper ocean in the Pacific. Secondly, you're dealing with small islands in the Pacific. The fear wasn't that the Japanese were going to respond with armored divisions, because the Japanese wouldn't have that capability to respond. The initial fear in the Pacific had been that the Japanese would respond with their navy. Once the Imperial Japanese Navy had been essentially reduced or made impotent, the American concern about a counterattack, a counter-response, had pretty much been neutralized. Very, very different situation in Europe. The biggest concern within Europe for the Allied planners was that the Germans would then know exactly where the Allied invasion was going to take place, and then they would respond with panzer divisions. Therefore, the Allies, the navies, did not have the luxury of spending days bombarding the defenses. They would essentially have to have a trade-off between stunning the defenders with a large, massive bombardment, but only for a short period of time, and then quickly attacking before the Germans could respond. So this was the great debate. Right now, some revisionist history has taken place, in which some historians have indicated that, well, why didn't the bombardment at Omaha Beach, for example, why wasn't it longer? Well, the real reason it wasn't longer was because they didn't have the time. They simply did not have the time to make that happen, because the Germans would have known immediately this is where they're landing, and therefore they would have responded with their heavy armor.
And you make a point here that is kind of subtle, that there was a very short window of opportunity to drop airborne divisions, do a bombardment, get in through the obstacles, and, as you say, a very dynamic tide, current, weather, right, environment there in Normandy. Talk a little bit about Normandy in the spring. It can be beautiful, but this was not one of those beautiful springs.
No. I mean, the weather was not particularly good. But I mean, on the note of just the short window, one of the overriding planning concerns, which sort of overrode everything, was that as the British and the Americans argued over when exactly each hour would be, when should they actually touch down, land the forces, and when should they set off for the invasion, when should they actually land? But different planners, different individuals had different points of view. So the Navy felt we need at least a certain amount of daylight so that we can attack the targets ashore. The infantrymen. So you had the 1st Infantry Division, and you had the different army planners indicating, well, we would rather have a high tide when we do this landing, because the closer we are to, we certainly don't want our infantry to be running across 1 mile of beach, because they're going to be taken out by whatever defenses are there. So the army's preference was to be in closer. The overriding decision. Oh, and then, of course, there's naval combat demolition units who felt they needed a low tide in order to take out, destroy, and take out the obstacles that were strewn across the beach. So you had different individuals with different perspectives arguing their point of view. The overriding planning concern, which ultimately established when H hour would be, was Montgomery's argument that he needed at least two full high tides to have his LSTs and other landing craft bring supplies in. And so that ultimately defined when H hour would take place.
Okay, and let's talk a little about the specialized tools and systems that were necessary for those initial assaults on that beach ocean interface. You must have gone through hundreds of documents talking about all kinds of ideas, that worked, some that must have seemed like psychotic. I mean, the rocket-propelled Panjandrum, which obviously was a brutal failure to the British who really supported it. And then, of course, you have Percy Hobart with his odd little funnies. Talk a little bit about some of the tools, the landing craft, the tanks and things that helped during those initial efforts to get off the beach.
Well, I mean, I mentioned already about the duplex drive tank, which was an amphibious tank. They would put one of these things on a landing craft tank, essentially put into water and then let these things go ashore as the initial armored support for the infantry landing at Normandy. The British had placed a lot more confidence in the DD tanks than the Americans, and in fact, one of the mistakes perhaps that the U.S. Navy may have made in this was Admiral Kirk, who was in charge of the Western Naval Task Force, was very concerned about bringing his task force in too close, and therefore he had the DD tanks come in from much, much further out. And I can't remember the exact number, how many nautical miles out, but they were put in the water much further out than had been the case for the British landings. And so many of those DD tanks went under due to the bad surf. And so several crews went down and drowned as a result of that. So the DD tank was one example of one of these devices. Another device that was utilized was a landing craft tank rocket. That is an LCT brought in with rockets placed on it to serve as gunfire, as artillery support, in addition to the duplex drive tanks and the naval gunfire support that was going to be coming from battleships, cruisers, and destroyers. Some of the other inventions that were utilized, they had what was known as a flail tank, a tank that would go ashore, and it had essentially trailing behind it chains and other material that would set off mines as it went by. The British had come up with a whole host of a lot of these different types of devices to help bring this about. And another invention, actually not necessarily made at Normandy, but had been devised, I believe, in the Southwest Pacific, was to use an early indication and warning tender. They'd have a ship out in the English Channel with some Air Force, Army Air Corps, Royal Air Force crew who had communications back to bases in England. And of course equipped with radar, if there was any indication that aircraft was coming in to attack the task force, they would then radio in and call for air cover and air support. That was another innovation, not necessarily from Normandy, but applied from another theater. So a number of different devices being utilized. They came up with everything. The other aspect of this was some of the deception that was utilized. So the Air Force flew missions in which they were dropping foil, Window, codenamed Window, to confuse German radar, to convince the Germans that there were tons of aircraft flying towards the Pas-de-Calais. So a whole bunch of different devices and tricks were being utilized by the Brits and the Americans to make Normandy happen.
Everything from rubber dummies to decoy aircraft to, of course, taking over the entire German spy network and compromising it and feeding back untrue information. Was there anything the Allies didn't try at some point to make Overlord a success?
One of the things that I'm not sure what the answer is to this, and your viewers may have an answer to this, but when I've gone to conferences or even done blogs, people have asked the question, why didn't the Allies use LVTs or landing vehicle tracks that were used, or Amtraks that were used in the Pacific, that perhaps those might have helped with the landing itself. And I've seen no evidence in any of the documents I've looked at to indicate that they were even raised as an issue. And that's one thing that I think perhaps was one thing that the Allies might have considered, but that they didn't. And it may have been the case that the U.S. Navy was using all of its assets and resources, its landing craft, everything, its LVTs in the Pacific, and was very reluctant to give over to the European theater. So it may have been, it may be possible that the U.S. planners, the U.S. Navy planners, felt we're not going to get that kind of support, so we might as well not ask for it. But that's the one thing that I'm curious about, and I don't know what the answer is to.
Do you see that as possible being tied into the institutional bias against involving the Marine Corps in the European theater? That, as you said earlier, Pacific was a Navy show, the European theater was an Army show.
Yeah, I think that could be the case. Now that you bring it up, I mean, I think there was one individual in that planning cell in London who was a Marine. Considering that the Marines had a great deal of amphibious experience, you would think that that more would have been brought over to be involved in that sort of planning. Now, to the credit of the U.S. Navy, they brought over individuals who had planning experience in the Pacific. But I saw very little U.S. Marine Corps participation in the planning, or at least in any of the discussions with regard to the best way to go about doing the Normandy landing. But it may be what you say. There may have been, or what I mentioned earlier, there may have been an institutional bias against bringing the Marine Corps in, bringing more influence of the U.S. Navy into the planning process. I mean, after all, the British felt, and we can talk a little bit about some of the personality clashes that happened during the planning, but the British felt, as you mentioned before, this is the English Channel. They have the Royal Navy sailed back and forth for quite a number of years. They felt very comfortable in the environment, operating in that area, what it involved, the geography of it. And so the Brits were almost resentful when the American naval planners would come up with different suggestions or ideas that they had learned from the Pacific. Now, to the British, to the credit of the British, or to be fair to the British, many of these ideas weren't applicable to the cross-channel to the cross-channel assault. It would be some instances of the United States Navy saying, "Well, this is how we do this in the Pacific. Why can't we apply this directly to the cross-channel assault?" So, to be fair to the Brits, in many instances, a lot of those suggestions weren't applicable. But I think there was also instances where Admiral Ramsay, who was the head naval, the Allied naval commander in chief, felt that this was a British show and that the Americans should essentially sit down and shut up and not give so many recommendations. That caused a lot of tension between him and the lead American planner, Admiral Kirk. And my book goes into great detail about how the two had a very tense relationship, almost until the day of D-Day and including even following the landings.
And let's talk about those command personnel. Obviously, Dwight Eisenhower was the top dog. Everybody had agreed, one man in charge, the supreme Allied commander, Dwight David Eisenhower, and of course, he had a primarily American staff led by then General Bedell Smith, who helped found the CIA. But talk a little bit about the other top commanders underneath him, what we would today call the COCOMs or component commanders, the JFAC, the Naval Forces Commander. Talk about who was in those jobs and what were their relationships like, both between themselves and with their boss, Eisenhower.
Well, I mean, I've mentioned Admiral Ramsay, so yes, Eisenhower had directly underneath him the COCOMs were all British, so he had essentially the individuals running the different services were essentially British general officers. So Admiral Ramsay was in charge of the naval portion of this, and underneath Admiral Ramsay, he had American and British naval commanders under him. For the Air Force, you had General Douglas, Sholto Douglas, was in charge of the the British effort. And then, of course, you had Montgomery. I'm sorry, I mix them up. Trafford Leigh Mallory was the commander of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. Trafford Leigh Mallory was essentially, many historians have argued that he was essentially a figurehead, and that Eisenhower's deputy commander, General Tedder, was the real brains behind the Air Force effort. So you had these individuals who, as you put it, were COCOMs. Historians argue to what extent Eisenhower had the power to tell any of these gents anything. They essentially were in charge of their services, and they had come up with the plans. Now, I would argue that Eisenhower had the power to essentially control these individuals to cooperate with one another. He was essentially the gent who had to make all of these individuals work together, and he had to get support from Churchill and from FDR and from the Joint Chiefs. So Eisenhower, I think, had a very, very tough job in balancing all these different personalities, all these different interests. One particular conflict that he had to deal with, and I don't go into detail in my book, was getting Strategic Bomber Command to play nice and cooperate. He couldn't get Bomber Harris or any of the Strategic Bomber staff to help him with regard to D-Day planning and to actually participate. He ultimately got 8th Air Force to participate in providing support and attacking targets, but it was like pulling teeth. So Eisenhower was essentially a circus ringmaster trying to keep a lot of personalities and individuals who had very strong parochial views on what their services should be doing to play nicely with one another and for the common cause of conducting the cross-channel assault.
And today we have a term that describes such processes as herding cats. In this particular case, you had Eisenhower, who wasn't just herding cats, but probably herding a herd of tigers in a real sense.
That's right.
These were not benign, submissive men. These were people, the cream of the Allied general officer and flag officer corps, and they all wanted to be part of the big show.
That's correct. That's absolutely the case. No less than Montgomery was one of he was definitely one of the individuals that Eisenhower had to stroke, make sure Montgomery's ego was being fed, but at the same time he had to make sure that Montgomery was playing nice with the others, and the same with Ramsey, who I think did an extraordinary job doing leading the naval planning, but Ramsey also had his biases, and also was very headstrong and felt things should be done a certain way. And Ramsey had his conflicts with his American subordinate, Admiral Kirk. And so sometimes you see Admiral Kirk going directly to Eisenhower, appealing to Eisenhower, which Ramsey did not appreciate. Ramsey felt that Kirk was doing an end run around his authority. So you see a lot of those types of actions, activities going on. If you look at some of the historical documents, there's in fact some evidence that Ramsey tried to have Kirk removed by appealing to the chief of naval operations. Actually, Ramsey had befriended the commander of Naval U.S. Forces Europe, Admiral Stark. And you see in Admiral King's biography, you see Admiral Stark sort of hinting in a very roundabout way that perhaps Kirk should be relieved and brought back home. And Admiral King decided not to do that they were too close to the actual date of the landing of the assault that he decided against it. The other personality conflict was between Admiral Ramsey and his British subordinate, Admiral Vian. Admiral Vian was very headstrong and was constantly having arguments with Admiral Ramsey, and Admiral Ramsey was very close to considering relieving Vian as well. So you see a lot of that going on. The tension building up before the cross-channel assault was something to think about, because here are these gentlemen, these naval and military officers thinking about the actual operation which will possibly bring about the end of the war. And so here you look at their diaries and you look at the things they were doing in order to make this happen. So they were under an extreme amount of pressure, enormous amount of pressure, to think through the plan and to think through what's going to succeed. In fact, one of the naval officers, Admiral Moon, cracked under the pressure. Not right there during the assault, but he following the D-Day landings, he was then dispatched to deal with the landings in southern France. He went to support Admiral Hewitt, and he cracked. He essentially committed suicide just prior to the southern France landings. So,
and thus
again,
the basis for one of my favorite films, The Americanization of Emily, with James Garner and Julie Andrews.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, that's where the screenwriters got the idea. Let's go back and talk a little bit about the guy who had the bottom line job of getting everybody from England to Normandy, Admiral Ramsay. Now, this is not a guy who is headstrong or lacks experience. It's worth noting he was the commanding officer with no notice and no real plan when he started that ran Operation Dynamo, which was the evacuation of Dunkirk in 1940. This guy knew how to transport large numbers of people between England and the coast of France. This was not an untalented individual. Talk a little bit more about him and the challenge that he faced, not just in personalities, but in talk about herding cats. Correct me if I'm wrong. He had 5,000 ships, boats, tugs, submarines, almost every kind of vessel except an aircraft carrier under his command, did he not?
That's correct. Let's talk about Ramsay a little bit. So first, yes, it's little known that he commanded both, was in charge of both Dynamo, the evacuation of Dunkirk, and the Normandy invasion. So it is interesting that he oversaw first the strategic retreat by the British and then the strategic return of the Allies. In between, he also was the lead planner, British planner for Operation Torch. So the Allied landing in North Africa, he oversaw that. The British side to the Allied landings in Sicily, he was also responsible for that. So yeah, the best amphibious planner on the British side was Admiral Ramsay. No question about that. Just a couple of other things to say about Ramsay. He was what you would call sort of the first. I don't know about the first, but he saw himself as a modern 20th century admiral. That is, he saw the need and importance of staff work and the use of staff. And actually, that philosophy got him in trouble as a rear admiral when he went to work for the commander-in-chief Home Fleet, who was of the view, and perhaps this is an old Royal Navy tradition of the commander-in-chief, the commander essentially doing everything and not really relying on a staff. So the Royal Navy tradition, perhaps going back to Horatio Nelson, I don't know. I don't know enough about the subject, but from what I've read of Ramsay's career was that he ran into trouble because he disagreed with his boss, felt that the boss needed to use his staff. He needed to use his chief of staff, which he was then at the time, and he needed to use his staff more. They had a professional disagreement, and Ramsay wasn't relieved, but he asked for a transfer. Now, unfortunately, at the time, this is, I guess, the early 40s, there were no other flag officer jobs available. So Ramsay essentially had voted himself out of a job, and his career sort of went into the tank at that moment. He for a while was then put on the retired list, inactive, and until Churchill brought him back and put him in the spot as Vice Admiral Dover, just in time for the Dunkirk operation that take place. So by pure chance and luck, we had Ramsay right where we needed him. His colleagues were all advancing and were much higher ranking than he because of his career mishap. But he was right where he needed to be when we needed him.
How did he stack up against probably his closest contemporary, Richmond Kelly Turner, the American amphibious admiral out in the Pacific. How did he stack up? Obviously, he did not have the alcoholism problem that Turner did, but they both were brilliant amphibious warfare specialists.
Yeah, I think what you see with both of those guys, it's hard to compare. I mean, I guess Terrible Turner, I guess is his nickname, was he was also a planner in the Pentagon, I guess a compatriot or a colleague of Eisenhower. So one thing that you can say about both of those, both Ramsey and Turner, were that they were adept at understanding what the other services needed. So Turner was very good at understanding ground force operations, air operations. He was able to understand amphibious doctrine writ large, whereas some of their colleagues would see things just purely from the naval point of view. Some would argue that Turner may not have seen things well enough because he was essentially what the gent who bolted when Guadalcanal got hot. But an objective observer might say, hey, listen, the Navy had to bolt because the Imperial Japanese Navy was coming. They had to somehow get out of the way and then come back. So I guess you could say that both were good at understanding what the other services needed. Both were very adept at understanding amphibious doctrine. Both were very good at making things happen when they needed those things to happen.
And so after years of preparations, more than a few dogfights bureaucratically, probably some alcohol-induced fist fights and other things, it comes to the spring of 44. It's time to go. Eisenhower has to do a weather delay on the 4th because there just is no weather window on the 6th. I mean, on the 5th. Moves it to the 6th. A weather window just barely opens up, and the decision is made to go. How does the Overlord plan work during that transport from England and starting to throw the troops up on the beach? How does it go?
Well, the actual plan, I think we can argue that it works very well. That is, this plan was in such detail, was the minutiae, when you look at Plan Neptune, is just I can't remember the exact page numbers, but it would weigh you down if you had to carry it out of the National Archives. But the plan worked very well. I mean, everything seemed to go into place. There were instances where landing craft went out of their lanes when they shouldn't have. But the task forces arrived in their areas, operational areas on time. The minesweeping plan, which we haven't talked about at all, went off very well. Surprise had happened. The Germans were taken by surprise, and the landings got off very well. Of course, the one hang-up, of course, was Omaha, the Omaha landings, which almost did not happen. Or did not happen successfully, but by and large, the landings worked out. Now, we're in a minute, we'll talk about what happened in the aftermath, which is a different story. But the actual D-Day and a few days after, the landings were a success. The Germans were taken by surprise, and the Allies were winning the buildup. The Mulberry Harbors were brought in, and LSTs were brought in and allowed to disgorge their supplies ashore. The airborne operations went off very well. So the actual D-Day plan worked out very well. The revisionist history or some of the complaints that you get from some of the participants, particularly the U.S. Navy, was that they felt that it was like reading a giant menu. They were not given any options in case something went wrong. What happens if they were repulsed? What would they do at that point? So the one complaint or criticism, primarily by the Navy, was that they felt that the plan was too rigid and that it didn't allow for flexibility or initiative by any of the commanders. Fortunately, that wasn't required. It didn't need any flexibility. Everything went off as planned. Everybody knew what they were supposed to do. The thousands of parts that moving parts that were involved went off like clockwork. And we're talking the need to land thousands of men ashore, and then to return some of these ships back to ports in England. They had to come back right to signed berthing spaces where they could then quickly reload and then go back out again. And so I can honestly say that just objectively looking at this thing, the plan did work very well, and it was a successful operation.
And even in the places like Omaha, where the fire support plan initially bogged down, eventually the destroyers were sent in close and just did an incredible job helping the troops, particularly from the 29th Division on the right flank, get off the beach and inland. I mean,
yeah, that's
the individual sterling qualities of the United States Navy did come through in the end.
Yes, yes. I mean, I personally looked at the logs of some of those destroyer captains who indicated that they made the decision to go in close. They could actually see the German defenders, and they were ordered them to take them out with whatever means necessary. So yeah, I guess to counter the Navy's criticism, I don't believe those destroyer captains were prepared or were even had thought that they would need to do that, but they took the initiative and went ahead and did, got in close and were taking out gun emplacements and other defenses on their own initiative.
Now, if you're a fan of that great war, you know, Darrell F. Zanuck war film, The Longest Day, you'd get the idea that, hey, we won the war on June 6th. But, you know, the sun did go down, and it came up on June 7th. And as the sun came up on June 7th, if you were one of the Germans who still had a beachside resort view, what were you seeing in the waters off of Omaha and the British beaches going on? Because if anything, it was busier in the days after D-Day than it was before. What would you have seen if you were sitting in one of the surviving pillboxes in Normandy?
Well, you would have been seeing just dozens and dozens of landing craft being brought in, different ferries bringing in different supplies just over and over again, just LSTs being brought in. What's amazing is the fact that the Allies were able, logistically, it's another feat. We haven't even talked about the ability, the requirements to just keep track of all that material brought in and in what order. And so if you're a German watching this all take place, you'd just be watching this massive buildup taking place right there before your eyes. Now, a few weeks later, this was all going to be thrown into disarray as the great storm of that June took place, and it wrecked dozens, if not hundreds, of landing craft and destroyed one of the Mulberry Harbors. So some of the setbacks the Allies ran into was this great storm that took place later on in the operation. And in addition, the Germans didn't just sit back after that first day. They were responding. So they were responding with whatever aircraft they could, dropping mines in the general area, which did cause casualties amongst the ships docked in the channel. So the Germans didn't sit back and take this lightly. And then I even found evidence that the Germans used what was called a human torpedo, where they were going in. I wouldn't call them suicidal missions, but they were going in, perhaps frogmen going in to try and put in demolition charges on Allied shipping. But they were trying everything they could possibly come up with to try and defeat the Allies.
And in the middle of this, as you were talking, you mentioned again the mulberries. How did you build a mulberry? What was a mulberry made out of? And I'm going to just start this by saying, you mentioned earlier that there was a breakwater, which was created using ships that were essentially sunk in place, up to and including the battleship Iron Duke, which was the flagship at the Battle of Jutland. Talk a little bit about the mechanics of building an artificial harbor on an open beach.
Well, let me do you one better. I think if I I think I can do it more justice if I just read what the description that I've written on, because I think I can do a better job by just reading what I've described, because I think it's quite complex. So let's see. So the Allies were confronted with the problem of how to cross the flats and reach out to piers where they would always be a minimum of 18 feet of water at all tides. To cross this gap from shore to piers, plans called for three lines of floating steel bridges resting on steel and concrete pontoons. These bridges were to be made up in 8-foot sections to be towed to the site, and they're linked together with telescopic spans. At low tide, some of the pontoons would rest on the sand. As a 21-foot tide came in, they would float. This floating bridge was known as would be known by the code word whale. The whales would then converge on a group of floating piers known as Leibnitz piers. Next, the ends of the piers had to be anchored so that their ends would not swing out and possibly break away with the shifting currents and tides. So for the seaward ends of the Mulberry, the Allies had developed special spud pier heads, which could be firmly fixed to the seabed and against which ships of small and even moderate tonnage could secure while discharging their cargoes, once unloaded, being driven ashore in trucks along the roadway pier linking the spud pier's head to the beach. And then finally, to provide an area where the larger ships, the pier heads, and the roadway would be sheltered from the effects of the sea, the plan called for the creation of some 146 concrete caissons, the largest displaying some 6,044 tons and the smallest 1,672 tons. These were to be towed across the channel, sunk in position end-to-end, and connected to serve as a giant breakwater known as a phoenix. 47 such phoenixes were needed to construct a 60-foot-tall breakwater at Mulberry A off Omaha Beach. So this was quite an engineering feat. Just to sink the concrete caissons where they needed to be, were on shifting sand on the right depth, must have been an engineering feat that I can't even imagine how they came up with that.
And yet, even through one of the worst storms ever recorded in the channel in late June, Mulberry B off of the British beaches survived and continued to go and supply the Allied effort well into the fall before we began to finally start getting those occupied ports in France and the Low Countries.
Yes, and in fact, I've heard one of the historians indicated that actually Mulberry B and all the supplies that were transported and loaded across it made it one of the largest ports in Europe at the time. I mean, I can't confirm that, but that's what I've been told by some historians.
Never fails to happen. Wherever we decide to go and put an American war effort down, that becomes the busiest portal in the world for a while.
So it seems.
Looking back, and given what all the time you spent looking at this, how successful were the gators of Neptune, all the different devices, the artificial ports, the funny tanks, the specialized landing craft, as well as the planning and the leadership. How successful were all of these things at going and doing this incredible job, which just 2 years earlier could not have been imagined? Talk a little bit about the achievement of that they did in that spring and summer of 1944.
Well, I think all of the tools. It's hard for me to sit there and say that any of the tools or devices had failed, because by and large they did what they were designed to do, and they were able to successfully land at Normandy. So I would say that just looking at the engineering feats, they accomplished what they set out to do. What's amazing to me, though, what amazes me just as much as the engineering feats is the doctrinal accomplishments. That is, all the tactical issues they had to wrestle with, plan for, and think through. They were able to sit there and think through, well, how do we go about doing this part of the operation? How do we go about doing this part of the operation? So doctrinally, there was plenty to argue about. The U.S. Navy had certain views of how to do the operation. The British and the Americans in the European theater had views on how they did things in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. So going into the direct planning of Operation Neptune, there was plenty to argue about. Should the aircraft be given control, be controlled by the amphibious task force commander, as the U.S. Navy argued was the case in the Pacific. Should there be centralized aircraft control from someplace in England, as the Royal Air Force, as the Air Force commander argued to be the case? So there were a whole host of doctrinal. How much naval gunfire support do we need? We've talked about some of these issues already. So there were a whole bunch of doctrinal tensions, conflicts, disagreements that a lot of the planners had gone into, and it amazes me that they were able to actually come out with a solid plan, taking lessons that they'd learned from different theaters throughout this World War, and to come up with the right plan to make this happen. So the accomplishments, not only engineering-wise, but doctrinally, and then I've talked about some of the personality conflicts. These folks were under a great deal of pressure politically. We haven't even talked about some of the pressures that the planners were coming under from the British chiefs of staff, from the American joint chiefs of staff, the pressures to get... So Kirk was being asked by Admiral Ramsey, see if you can get more material to be sent to England from the United States, and you had Admiral King back in Washington indicating, no, I have a war to fight in the Pacific, so I'm not going to send material. So you had the political aspects of this. I haven't even talked at all about Churchill's involvement. He wanted to be involved in every aspect of this. He would show up at planning meetings and was even engaged in the discussion over when to set H hour. So you had Churchill wanting to get involved. You had the King of England wanted to be involved. They both wanted to go to be on a ship during the assault itself, which Admiral Ramsey had to veto. They went to Eisenhower, asked him about it. So to me, this is Operation Neptune Overlord was an amazing success, both from an engineering point of view, a doctrinal point of view, and a personal and human drama point of view. I think almost every aspect of this is just a fascinating, compelling read.
And you haven't even mentioned de Gaulle and the French.
Haven't talked about de Gaulle and the French and the political issues that Eisenhower would have to deal with. So there are a whole... There's so many elements of this story that you could keep peeling away at the story and still come up with something interesting. I even stumbled upon, as I was doing research, the OSS involvement in this thing. So covert operations prior to the Normandy landing. So in the National Archives, I ran into OSS coming to the Navy and saying, we need the use of landing craft in order to conduct surveillance and reconnaissance and collect intelligence. So I didn't go into detail over that research, but that's even an element that I think is underexplored with regard to this story.
You've told a great story today, and you know you've had a very successful book. In talking with your publisher, your book has sold through. You know, it's very hard to find a copy unless you're willing to go ask for it from a used bookseller. And what do you want to do now? I mean, you obviously did very good work on Gators of Neptune. Do you have another book in mind? Is there something else that intrigues you enough to go ahead and put your marriage and your family life on hold at risk to go write something?
Before I answer that question, a wise author once told me, or a wise scholar once told me, one marriage, one book.
Well, you've now told me why I shouldn't get married, having written 15 up, you know.
I would point out that he violated that phrase several times. So, but you're right. Engaging in this type of endeavor does take up a lot of your time, and I do want to give a shout out to my wife Teresa, who put up with me making long road trips to go do archival research and other things, and my boys who didn't see their dad for quite a while, you know, for weekends I would disappear. But to answer your question, yeah, the Army historian friends of mine have urged me to take on MacArthur's Southwest Pacific campaigns. That is, they want me to take a hard look at the operational design and the thinking that went into the amphibious landings for MacArthur's campaign in the Southwest Pacific. And fully acknowledging that MacArthur was a megalomaniac, no question about that. that he was a glory hound and certainly tried to eclipse any of his subordinate commanders. I'm not going to argue against that point. The question I have is, was it MacArthur who and his staff who said, listen, the way to take on the Japanese is to outflank them, to conduct operational maneuver around them, and to design our entire strategic campaign in the Southwest Pacific based on that fact, and to be innovative and think of ways to be able to conduct that type of operation. That's what I think should be my next project. The Southwest Pacific campaign, unlike Normandy, which is sort of one specific, I could focus on one specific amphibious landing. This would require me looking at all the landings that MacArthur and his staffs and his subordinate armies had to think through. And so I think I'm going to be wrestling with that one next.
It's a big challenge, but I don't think it's ever really been written about very much.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping it'll I'm hoping I'll find new things and can reveal certain things about that campaign and certainly put to rest the idea. Essentially, I want to get to the idea that, I mean, how much was it MacArthur and how much of it was his subordinates? How much of it was it the fact that the different services came up with innovations to deal with this? I just want to get to know that answer. That to me is a compelling story that needs to be told. And of course, I'll have to acknowledge, yes, MacArthur had his issues, and I'll have to deal with those head on.
Well, it's not like you take on simple or easy topics, sir.
Well, I appreciate that compliment. I don't think my job is to just take on easy topics. I think the job as the historian and the scholar is to take on subjects that are tougher to deal with. That's what makes it compelling and interesting to read.
In addition, you have your day job, too. You are a professor over at National Defense University. What kinds of things are you planning on teaching here in the next couple of years?
Well,
have you been giving guidance on where the curriculum is going?
Well, there are two parts of National Defense University. There's the Joint Professional Military Education side, made up primarily of the National War College, the Eisenhower School, which is formerly the Industrial College of the Armed Forces. And then there's the research side of the university, which essentially serves as the research arm, an organization of the Joint Staff and the Office of Secretary of Defense. I am on the research side of the house. So I have taught classes of various subjects. My primary function is to provide research to the Office of Secretary of Defense and the Joint Staff. My day job is more related to Asia-Pacific security, China maritime issues, China military issues, and that's what I focus my day job on. The fact that I happen to also be an expert on amphibious and maritime history, I think, plays well in the fact that the Chinese are thinking about amphibious operations in Taiwan, South China Sea, and perhaps even in the Indian Ocean and other areas. So I combine those two bits of expertise to the job, so I find it interesting to be able to combine those two parts of my brain.
Sounds like fun. I want to thank you for coming on today. I hope we can have you on the show again sometime to talk about an issue of which you can comment. And thanks for taking the time. We do appreciate it.
John, I appreciate the invitation, and I welcome any comments, or if anyone has any questions for me, please let me know.
Take care. And with that, we are going to go ahead and wrap up the show. We went a little long today, but that's one of the nice things about Military Monday. We're a little flexible, and if we need to go long, we can. I want you to all go and have a safe, productive, and prosperous week ahead, and we will hopefully be able to go ahead and talk to you next week on Military Monday. Goodbye.